Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 161 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, back home in Austin, woo-hoo, back in the cave with Steve and Julie.
Yeah, it's
been
back,
a quick minute or two. I've been on the road for close to a month and getting ready to go back on the road. And one of the people that I ran across while I was on the road and just kind of started pinging back and forth with on various forms of social media was Shahid Buttar. And when I first found him, he was working for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, people who work for the advocacy of individual digital rights, things like that. And since then has decided to run for California's 12th congressional district. And we are so, so happy to welcome Shahid to the show. How are you doing this evening, Shahid?
I'm stoked to be with you.
Oh, fantastic. well, we're on a little bit different time zone. I was in your time zone for about a week or so here recently. How are things going out there in California, and how are things going in your present district race?
You know, every day for me is sun up to sun, you know, sun up to midnight sprint, I should say. And I think as beautiful as the days are here in California, I think they mask a lot of the struggles that people in my community, and I think a lot of different cities around the country, struggle with. An affordable housing crisis in urban areas, a healthcare crisis, a system that is failing us. But that notwithstanding, I'm very excited to offer the voters in San Francisco an alternative. And did you ask how things are going in the race, right? Is that part of the question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're moving a mile a minute. We've been racking up endorsements, most recently Veterans for Bernie, that join a whole host of groups, the SF Tenants Union, the SF Bernie-crats, the League of Tistoff Voters.
Nice.
Progressive. Yeah, so we're sort of consolidating support across the different communities in the city. And I'm excited to see that consensus emerge that Nancy Pelosi needs to go, and we need to have a new, fresh voice representing America's most progressive city in Washington.
Well, you know, and I could not agree with you more. We talk about politics quite a bit on this show. And, you know, one of the things I've questioned for the longest time is, why is it that the people who are sitting right now, you know, in congressional hearings on Facebook and privacy and things like that, why are they people that are literally so old they do not know how the internet works? Yet still, these are the people who are deciding what our digital rights are. These are the people that are deciding the future of the internet and the future of information and our digital privacy as we know it. And they don't even know how that
operates. They don't
grasp it.
I literally watched the entire first day of that before this show.
They're going to make a lifelong decision.
I remember trying to get you on for it, Shahid, and it was just one of those that was like, wow, how do none of these people have any? I mean, is it just all their interns that take care of everything?
Nice.
So tell us.
I mean, you're right to observe it.
Yeah.
You're observing illiteracy in power, which is irresponsible.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I couldn't put it any better. You were observing illiteracy of power, and the fact that those in charge are illiterate to the technology means to me that they're also more than likely illiterate to the ultimate repercussions of said technology. You know, tell us a little bit about your platform, and what was it exactly that spurred you to run right now, Shahid?
I'll answer those in reverse order. The thing that spurred me to run was watching Pelosi undermine a proposed warrant requirement that would have constrained domestic surveillance by NSA, FBI, and DEA, and instead, essentially extending by 6 years and expanding beyond the prior baseline the mass surveillance powers available to the Trump administration. And that was an abdication of constitutional responsibility that I really was loath to witness. And it got sharper for me a month later when she gave the president his proposed budget without any support for immigrant students who've been brought to the country when they were young. And I'm an immigrant myself. I'm an immigrant privacy advocate. You know, I fight for the rights of all Americans, and to watch her over the course of a few weeks both undermine the rights of the community I come from and the community that I represent was a little more than I could bear. And it pushed me off the sidelines. You know, my attitude about this is, if we are going to allow the continued accretion of executive power and just hurtle unapologetically into an authoritarian abyss, I at least want to throw myself on the track. So that's what I'm doing. The platform for me really starts there with constitutional rights, particularly the First and the Fourth Amendment principles undermined by mass surveillance, principles undermined by torture, principles undermined by mass incarceration and militarized police. And I aim to defend those constitutional principles against the metastasis of the bipartisan metastasis of executive power that we've witnessed in the last generation. I want to legalize cannabis at the federal level to end the war on drugs. And both as a civil rights imperative and as a stimulus measure for green jobs. There are a ton of green jobs and opportunities available to our country and the next generation of workers if we just adopted a sane drug policy. And hemp was once required for farmers to raise as a national security imperative, because that's how we built sales for the Navy.
That's
right. And the idea that it went from being compulsory to prohibited. Please go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say, even the term legal tender meant that you were bartering and trading in hemp.
Right.
Like the term that our money comes from. Though, so, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt, Shai.
No, not at all. I you know, we're on the same page. And I think you're observing just more dimensions through which the preposterousness of prohibition emerges. And especially when you think about the civil rights travesty it has enabled in a prison industrial slavery complex that legally enslaves more Americans today than were subject to slavery at the height of the institution before the Civil War, should gall all of us. And the only thing better about slavery today is that it's multiracial. And I don't, you know, that's, you know, say what you will about that. At the end of the day, the prison industrial slavery complex is a racket, and it reflects corruption just as much as the bipartisan emergence of a corporate establishment that undermines the shared interests of a transpartisan base. So I'm sort of circling around this idea of representing people who are Americans before they are either Democrats or Republicans. Those are the people I aim to represent. Americans, as a majority, agree that cannabis should not be illegal. We agree that the Pentagon shouldn't be siphoning off all our social resources, and if you're going to get taxed, you know, at least some of that tax money should find its way back into social services. And that's how I want to secure Medicare for all, affordable college. I want to house every veteran. I think it's insane that there are homeless veterans in my district. You cannot walk home without passing a veteran sleeping on a cardboard box in the rain, and it is shameful.
You quite literally there in San Francisco are dealing with one of the worst homelessness situations in the country right now. I want to say that the statistic is that there is one homeless person for every 2 to 3 regular San Franciscans.
I don't think it's quite that. And the population of the city is about 750,000, and I think about 20,000 homeless folks in the city. But you're right. It is absolutely acute. And it's horrifying, and it's senseless. I mean, 11% of the homeless population around the country are veterans. And the idea that there are people who are served in uniform, and the idea that there are Americans of all political stripes who proudly display bumper stickers that say, "I support our troops," while the Pentagon hurls money at Lockheed Martin to build, you know, joint strike fighter platforms that are going to cost $1.5 trillion over the next 50 years while there are veterans sleeping outside under the rain is unconscionable. Right. And the idea that members of Congress are willing to sign off on those budgets and fail in their oversight responsibilities is an abdication of their constitutional responsibility. I'm not willing to watch that go down on my watch. And that, maybe I should just make that point frontally too. Oversight is a big reason I'm running. I am an advocate for everyone's rights. That's what I've been my whole career. And I've watched the concerns of communities fall on deaf ears among policymakers who are empowered to ask tough questions, and they won't, either because they're not sharp enough to do it or because they're not inclined to do it. And I am inclined enough and sharp enough to have been arrested asking questions about mass surveillance and double standards in the rule of law that no member of Congress has ever demonstrated the independence of the acumen to raise. And, you know, the opportunity to do that with a seat instead of, you know, as a citizen journalist getting arrested for asking questions is one that I would aim to leverage on behalf of my constituents and the Constitution.
Well, and tell us a little bit about your time in citizen journalism and what it was that that I guess opened your eyes really and spurred you on, because quite honestly, that was a lot of what started this show, was the fact of I saw so much going on in news that unfortunately, unless it is your job to look at news all day, it's hard to decode what's going on.
Right, you never said.
It's hard to actually see the swath of things that are going on at all times.
Right.
And just that, just trying to crack that nut to begin with, much less trying to have an open-ended conversation like our country used to. Where we can agree to disagree, where we can hear each other's point of view and not be vehemently at each other's throats. You know, like there is no constructive way to get anything accomplished by doing that. And whenever you said that your focus is on people who say that they are American before they say they are Democrat or Republican, I couldn't put that a more beautiful way. It's really time to kind of break that social structure that we have in politics in this country of red versus blue.
Because we're not divided at all, you know?
Yeah.
That mindset is what they like us to think.
Yeah. I think the greater concern, really runs across the whole gamut, with everyone.
Yeah. The way I describe it, and I think you guys are all over it. I think we are divided, but it's not left versus right. It's not red versus blue. It's people versus power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how we're divided. And power is running roughshod over all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to fight back against that is to realize our shared interests. I mean, an example of this, just to remix an answer to the question about the platform, a lot of people are concerned about threats to the integrity of our election system, whether it's and while the issue du jour particularly is election and culture hacking, which I can come back to later.
Sure.
The issues I'm concerned about at the moment are like gerrymandering, voter suppression, campaign finance. One of my earliest battles as a young lawyer was trying to defend the McCain-Feingold law that in 2002, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, which tried to take corporate soft money out of elections. And we fought a case, Shays versus FEC. I defended the House co-sponsors of the measure, Republicans, and their interests vis-a-vis the Federal Election Commission. And we won that case before the D.C. Circuit, defending campaign finance regulations to keep corporate money out of elections 4 years before the Supreme Court destroyed everything we'd worked on in the Citizens United case. And rather than play this legislative whack-a-mole where parties and campaigns come up with new ways to undermine the fairness and competition in our election system, and then waiting for Congress for 10 years to figure it out and legislate, and another 10 years for the courts to come around and block it, I would like to simply extend the reach of existing antitrust laws that already prohibit companies from doing what political parties do routinely, and extend those laws to also guard competition in political markets. So, for instance, horizontal competitors like McDonald's and Burger King or Pepsi and Coca-Cola, they can't get together in a boardroom and divide territory and say, okay, you sell on the west side of town, we'll sell on the east side of town, we won't have to compete with each other so we can jack up the price and screw everyone over. That's illegal already. But political parties do that all the time.
Absolutely.
That's how most states allocate their congressional districts, is nothing but horizontal competitors colluding to undermine the interests of their constituents. You know, so I have some novel ideas about how to break concentrations of power, and antitrust law is very much my inspiration for doing that. You know, I don't hear members of Congress proposing ideas like that. I don't hear members of Congress. You know, you asked me at one point about my citizen journalism piece. I've never heard anyone ask James Clapper, except for me, how he got away with lying to the Senate under oath. Mass surveillance without ever getting charged with perjury. While not long after he did that, Eric Garner was choked to death in the street in New York City on the mere suspicion of selling cigarettes without a license. And the idea that as a powerless person, you can be killed without a charge or a trial on the suspicion of a trivial offense, while powerful officials can commit grave offenses against the Republic on the public record and walk out with a pension, is, you know, it gets my goat.
Yeah, it's and that's just it. It's definitely something that
is more than
abuse of power.
Yeah.
It goes straight into criminal. And unfortunately, it seems that the talk of the day right now is the concept of the career politician, you know, the people who like Feinsteins and stuff like that, who have been around for 30 years.
Congress.
Like Pelosi's, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. People who, you know, I find it funny how an 80-year-old is like weighing in on the future of the internet. They don't even grasp the internet.
Preposterous.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's one of those. It's like,
it's too horrifying to be comic.
Yeah, and it really is kind of too horrifying to be comic. Exactly, and the fact that we now have career politicians, people who have been in office for 40 years. You look at people like Strom Thurmond, even longer than that. And yet still we wonder why progress is stymied, why nothing gets actually accomplished, other than on a corporate level with things. So,
yeah, I think there's a real problem here in terms of people perceiving themselves as entitled to power. And I see that very much in the incumbent, you know, I respect her very much, and I appreciate the contribution she's made to the country in her early days as a legislator. In particular, she was outspoken, and I especially appreciate, you know, the way she's broken glass ceilings for women. You know, but when you don't show up to debate anybody since 1987,
she's just complacent now.
It seems to me that that should be disqualifying.
Like he said, since 87. Like if you don't show up to debate a point, to question a vote, to, you know, like you basically show up, you vote, and then you go home.
You don't even do the bare minimum.
That is literally the bare minimum.
Yeah.
And like he said, pulling a pension at the same time. You know, getting ready to be paid.
Yeah.
For life,
like takes an act of God for something to happen, and you be like kicked out for something or other. Not doing your job.
As someone who stands for the change that you stand for, are you pro term limits for representatives and senators?
Yeah, I would. I'm not opposed to it. The reason I've heard that term limits can be challenging is that they force out people with expertise. And there's a difference between expertise and ossification.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example. There was a member of the Senate, Senator Russ Feingold, who was one half of that measure to try to take money out of politics back in 2000. He was the only vote in the Senate to oppose the Patriot Act. The same year that the Supreme Court invited open corruption in the Citizens United decision, someone bought his Senate seat for $5 million, and he's been out of politics ever since. If he was in the Senate armed with the experience that he had, I've very sorely missed Russ Feingold's voice in the Senate, and I think his absence on the Intelligence and the Judiciary Committee has been palpable, because he was really the only one who was willing to really fight. And Ron Wyden sort of stepped into his shoes, but, you know, Ron Wyden is no Russ Feingold. And I think there's a case to be made for expertise. I think that, to me, the difference between when I am inclined toward term limits and when I am not really turns on who we are talking about with respect to the limits. And I think there's a big difference between members of Congress who pay heed to their constituents, who do their job, who show up to debate, who exercise their oversight responsibilities. Those are the kinds of people, quite frankly, I'd like to stay in. And we don't have enough of them. So I think of it as a term limits are a sharp rule where I would much rather see just electoral accountability and people vote out members who don't do their jobs.
I think it definitely starts there. I would think more along the lines of like, okay, much like any company, you spend 20 years in, you're vested in. That's great. But like you said, you had to have been actively voting. hey, how about we stop paying you out of a federal coffer and you're paid by your constituents again?
There you go.
You're actually paid by your area, and then you can be held fully accountable. Yeah,
you do a good job, you get paid.
Well, and a friend of mine for years, there was in the last election, there was actually a meme that was going around with senators and stuff wearing what would be the equivalent of like a NASCAR jacket. With
the NASCAR.
You can see who's bought and paid for by who.
Exactly. I like that. Facebook, DuPont,
Who's the biggest one on the back?
I think that's the best idea.
Who's got that big back?
Corporate reps should at least disclose who they're bought by.
Yeah. And, I think that's the concern that we have right now in today's society, that you are so eager to address and so ready to take on full force, is the fact of corporate involvement in politics and that kind of stuff. I'd like you to address that for a minute for us and for our audience.
Sure. And I wouldn't even, go stronger than corporate involvement and describe it as corporate control
Perhaps
corporate corruption, right? Like when corporations buy both parties and they're assured of outcomes that undermine workers and families and advance their interests, regardless of the electoral outcome, something is wrong. And that's kind of been the case in the United States for the last 20 or so years. We used to have a Labor Party and a capital party. And, the Democrats sort of became a corporate party under the Clinton administration. And the Republican Party moved even further to this under Trump, particularly further towards a very dangerous form of, you can't call it conservatism because it doesn't conserve anything. It's conservatism in the way that a fire is conserved, by burning everything to the ground. And the assault on broad principles. And you can see this in a lot of different dimensions. I choose healthcare as maybe the most glaring example of this. Nancy Pelosi represents the most progressive district in the country. There is a rising consensus for single-payer, government-paid Medicare for All, which would drive the cost of healthcare through the floor. It would expand access to preventive care. It would prevent homelessness, because that's one of the primary ways that people end up homeless, is having to pay corporate medical bills. It would increase the strength of American businesses, because it's only here in the United States that businesses have to uniquely shoulder the cost of their employees' health care. So it would help small businesses. It would help startups. It would help big businesses. It would keep people from being homeless. It would expand human rights. It would reduce the cost of health care. Why don't we have it? Because corporations lobbying under the Obama administration killed the public option under the Affordable Care Act. And so we're left with basically, a policy that progressives have ended up defending, even though it was pioneered by the Heritage Institute and first deployed by a Republican governor, Mitt Romney, in Massachusetts. And it's not a progressive policy.
Whenever that happened, I remember specifically, it's modeled after the success of Romney Care. And I'm like, I don't know. I know quite a few families that is really come down on come tax time, where they literally just get pinned. Mm-hmm. Like my sister-in-law being one of them, with married with three children, stuff like that. If they did not have Romney Care, they were fined through the roof. With the healthcare system, and it was everything that they could do to barely even be able to afford
Ridiculous.
To be in the program.
Kick a man while he's down, right?
That's exactly it. It's kicking someone while they're down. The idea that there is a tax penalty for people who are struggling to afford health insurance.
Yeah,
and, you've seen what has happened to the rates since the program was put in place. They've gone, just as one might predict, through the roof, because there's no accountability mechanisms to prevent the corporate profiteering that now is taking place behind the subsidy of a tax penalty. And, the the short-sightedness of so-called liberals who abandon their own principles at the drop of a hat because it's their guy writing the, you know, signing the law. I when I was in Washington, I worked for a while at the American Constitution Society for Law and Policy, which was founded after the Bush versus Gore decision to try to restore some balance in the law and by cultivating a new generation of jurists who might be more thoughtful with respect to our constitutional principles than the sort of revolutionaries who had come out of the Federalist Society. And I was very central in that network. I spent a lot of time and I pissed a lot of people with it off when I think it was 2011, probably 2013. I wrote a petition with Credo Mobile challenging and trying to stop a nomination to the First Circuit Court of Appeals of an Obama Justice Department lawyer who wrote the memo authorizing drone strikes targeting American citizens without charge or trial based on their speech.
Yeah.
And the idea that that's someone who should be making laws and determining how the law applies to the rest of us is the same thing as John Yoo, who was in that very same office under the Bush administration authorizing enhanced interrogation practices that violated international human rights commitments that we fought a world war to establish in the first place.
That's
no,
right.
No judge, and, no jury. You know, this,
you're just, right. But it's to going back to your question about the corporate domination. I mean, I see these issues get implicated and it's sort of hard to untangle. And I'm going to cite an authority here, no less credible than the last U.S. president who was a war hero who fought and won World War II. Dwight Eisenhower warned us before leaving office that companies plus defense equals the end of democracy unless we have a knowledgeable and alert citizenry. When I look at NSA surveillance, I see a corporate racket. When I see militarized police, I see a corporate racket. When I see prisons that are growing faster than schools,
privatized
I see a corporate racket.
Yeah, all privatized. Of these,
even worse.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, we have them here in Texas. We have them all over the country. It's gotten to where most of the prisons that we have are privately run in some way, shape or form, or at least privately subsidized in some way, shape or form. And to even think about that. And like you said, going back into being able to use drones on American citizens. I remember
that's a big one of ours.
I remember we've talked about that frequently
about
on
this
show, and I remember distinctly the night that the Dallas shootings were happening. Stephen came over to my house.
Yeah.
It was about 2 a.m.
Yeah, we were watching it together.
When the sniper was shooting at Dallas police.
Yeah, the robot came in.
Yeah, the robot came in, not with like a tear gas grenade or anything else, a straight up fragmentation grenade and just killed him.
Yeah.
And everybody was just all right with it.
They were just kind of passed by. Nobody questioned the rights of this, you know, the guy that still had rights, even though, you know, hey, he didn't get a court date yet.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he still has rights. And then, like, you know, dead man can't tell stories, can he?
It was interesting, to say the least, to just see them, like, choose the choice of lethal option, you know, and just blow him up by a remote.
Kind of jumped over some things.
And that was one of those that just really raised our attention to that topic as it came about. And it seems to be happening more and more, especially with FISA courts, FISA warrants, things like that. You were talking earlier about the Patriot Act, and not many people realize, but once you add certain terminology to things, once you categorize something into a certain area, it just directly falls under that jurisdiction. And there's nothing you can really do about it. Like, people will be FISA warranted. People will be taken into custody with rights violations full on. And to think about that and to know that is kind of frightening.
One of the dangers with respect to the FISA issues is that there's very rarely a warrant for an individual.
Yeah.
Now, these usually are mass warrants for like millions of people at once, which is exactly, you know, part of the problem. And just in the last few days, the NSA disclosed that the number of searches and collection relative to prior years has been escalating dramatically.
Right.
These are the kinds of issues that members of Congress, you know, have not been aggressive in investigating. And because they happen behind walls of secrecy, they're the only people who are empowered to explore these issues. And, you know, there's a lot to be worried about the evolving and expanding abuses of those issues. In the last year, the number went up 300%. There were almost half a billion records collected, and this was under the Patriot Act.
Right.
And, you know, there's a whole bunch of legal requirements for disclosure that the agency is failing. And, you know, it's not subject to the transparency and the checks and balances that we should expect living in a constitutional republic.
Yes.
And
thank you for calling it what it is.
If we're going to live in a country... No, I appreciate it. I mean, I'll hit it harder than that. If we're going to live in a country that is committed to mass incarceration and mass surveillance, we should at least change the anthem and stop singing a load of malarkey about living in a land of the free.
Yeah.
The land of the locked up.
Well, and
and intimidated. You know, I mean, free people wouldn't accept
scared
it.
Scared to death.
Well, and so often because I post a lot of news articles, things like that, things along this line in our Dudes and Beer Facebook group. And I have some good friends who respond all the time, well, I got nothing to hide.
Yeah,
and it's like,
that
well,
old saying,
just because you got nothing to hide doesn't mean that you should actively be treated like a criminal.
Exactly.
You see.
You're giving you're giving your right away, and then here you are thinking that saying that you're saying, and when you think nothing's wrong, guess what? Whatever you may be giving them, they might think something's wrong. And then that's when, once they come after you, then you realize, whoa, shoot.
Yeah, they wanted to find something.
Now I disagree with that, right?
Yeah.
Now they're knocking at your door. Now they're coming for you. Now you disagree with that. Now you see, you know.
Well,
all those are legit points, but there's another reason to be concerned here. Think about it through this line. For decades in the United States, speech by particular communities has been treated not just as criminalized, but as a national security threat. I'm thinking particularly about Puerto Ricans who advocated independence.
Absolutely.
Or Native Americans who advocated for their treaty rights, or African Americans who sought civil rights in the 60s. Or for that
That's
matter,
right.
women who were promoting the Equal Rights Amendment, people trying to end the war in Vietnam. We have long had vicious domestic constraints on speech that took the form of targeted surveillance, infiltration, what the FBI called disruption and neutralization, which included documented plots to drive civil rights leaders to suicide. Now,
that's
you know,
right.
despite our rhetoric and our textual commitments,
sounds like Bob Marley
that's U.S.
right
history.
There.
So, if, well, but follow me here. This is why there's a way this all fits together. If that's the history, and let's just say you're part of one of those communities today, one of the communities that has been targeted. The fact that the government is collecting everything, the fact that there are no limits on state surveillance, would not only be a privacy violation, it's an autonomy restriction. It diminishes agency, it restricts speech, which is to say it kills not the interests of any particular community or individual, it kills democracy.
That's right.
Which is what the Constitution was set up to protect. And, you know, every time somebody thinks about surveillance undermining privacy, I feel the need to, like, share a little bit of information, because it's not privacy I'm worried about. I mean, privacy matters, but it is ultimately democracy that I am concerned about. And that is what is at stake here. And that's exactly what we need members of Congress to stand up to defend. They all swear oaths to defend it. And when the time comes to defend it, you know, they're all off fundraising. And
yeah. And I couldn't have put that any better.
We can do better.
We should do better, and we should expect better. We should want better as people, as active members of that democratic republic. You know, the fact that we are supposed to have representatives who do what we want and what is in our best interest, not in the best interest of a pocketbook or in a campaign financer. You know,
that's exactly right.
The issues going on right now, of course, anything going on with Cambridge Analytica, Facebook, and it's come out recently that, of course, Cambridge Analytica also got information from Twitter There was a big push this last week or so from Twitter to say, please come change your password. We have found weak links.
Oh, they're pulling this Yahoo
in our security. Well, Yahoo in and of itself was one that they took 5 years to release those numbers. And once the numbers actively came out, it was pretty much every Yahoo account in existence. It was like a third of the planet.
Had been hacked.
You know, and
I was part of the. I was recruited by the State Department in the 90s to serve as a diplomat, and so I went through a security clearance process. The Office of Personnel Management got hacked for 6 months by the Chinese state intelligence agencies, who exfiltrated everything from, every address I ever looked at over the course of my life to the home addresses of CIA employees. That's all in the hands of the Chinese government. I mean, the Yahoo abuse with the Yahoo hack was bad.
Yeah,
I just cite the OPM hack to indicate that the illusion of online security is very much an illusion, and there are a lot of people waging a very high stakes,
no existing
war in the background that most people don't see.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at that, minus that, if you look at the three major hacks before that, things like Target, and it really started back in the day with the Hannaford hack.
Which one was that?
It was Hannaford Grocery Stores up in the Northeast.
Oh, I think I do.
It was when I lived in Maine, and that was one of the first ones that came out where it was like tens of thousands of people had their information stolen via Hannaford debit skimmers and things like that.
Yep.
And it just began this unfolding somehow of even Nordstrom was involved, it's gone down the line through American society and through American economics, and pretty much the statistic is if you have purchased something online in the last decade, you have been compromised.
For sure.
And a lot of times when people are compromised, you never find out. It's not like the company writes you all the time to say our systems were breached, but like a notice of breach responsibility is also a no-brainer that Congress has never seen fit to legislate, and creating these obligations for companies that house user data that would require them, for instance, to respect user choice, respect an opt-in limit, for instance, or give users an opportunity to download all of their own content that they may have generated. Congress has a habit of exercising, we've discussed in a couple different contexts, Facebook and those hearings, the national security arena, how poorly executed is the project of congressional oversight. On the rare occasion that Congress does get up and legislate something, often there are a lot of unintended consequences that the body creates. And I particularly point to SESTA and FOSTA. These were two laws passed, one by the Senate, one by the House earlier this year, that aimed to address sex trafficking. And in the end, what they basically did was encourage online censorship. And, that's exactly what we should not be doing. Because least when you're censored by the government, you have theoretical rights. When you're censored by companies, you don't have any rights at all.
Yeah. And in reference to that, folks, what he's talking about is, of course, the new laws that came about via sex trafficking that, of course, shut down Craigslist personal ads, shut down all kinds of personal things like that, personal ad online stuff.
That's the Backpage town, is
Backpage,
that?
Backpage,
yeah. And, it does come down to one of the questions I've had from the beginning, and that I've questioned since the beginning of net neutrality, is the granting of purview of the internet to the FCC is just troubling to me, especially without actively rewriting the charter of the FCC, because all they do is regulate the sale and use of airwaves. That's it. They regulate the sale and use to broadcast signal.
Right.
So if you have a license to use it, what you're using it is within public RF frequencies, things like that, they're the ones that come in and enforce that. there is nothing broadcast about the internet in that way.
But it's under them.
But it's now under the purview of the FCC.
Right.
And
see how that's like. What?
It really does set forth the concept that we've talked about numerous times.
Calling apple an orange, right?
Well, it was funny that about 6 months before that is when the ICANN registry started. Which is where if you start a website, you have to go internationally register it in your name, stuff like that. Alibaba, if I'm not mistaken, the big bust with Alibaba is what made that happen full on. Well, it was a few years ago, but it just odd to me that purview of the internet would be given to the FCC to begin with without actively rewriting their charter.
You know, it's not crazy to have a charter reform of the FCC that would clarify the body's authorities. At the moment, though, just given that we have the FCC that we're working with, I think that the need for the FCC to regulate, for instance, net neutrality provisions is critical because it's going to be very hard to maintain a robust First Amendment going forward if net neutrality is not ensured online as a matter of law. And the only body poised to do that is the FCC under its authority to regulate the internet as an information service. Now, to your point, I'll note an area where the FCC I've noticed has abandoned its responsibilities. For instance, when police departments use cell site simulators, stingrays, to spoof cell networks, basically interfering with legitimate cell traffic, including potential emergency signals, without judicial warrants, as happens in most states. And the FCC is just not there. When it's its responsibility to ensure that people can, for instance, access the emergency telephone network instead of being really intercepted by police running some investigation without any oversight. So the FCC is both needed, I think, in a lot of arenas that it has recently abdicated, like ensuring net neutrality, and it's needed in areas that it is long abandoned, like protecting communities' access to cell networks.
Yeah,
well, so I don't want to. All I'm saying here is that the FCC is particularly under this administration and its current appointees. I think the FCC is entirely too interested with defending the interests of corporate internet service providers and not with the interests of its users.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and not just that, but I mean, it did just come out that Stingray was actively being used in DC, stuff like that.
Right.
That kind of stuff is being used all over the place. And it seems like we in our American society nowadays have such a true short-term memory complex when it comes to this stuff. Yep. Like, does anybody remember the revelation of PRISM? Right here, Steve. Does anybody remember why Edward Snowden right now is a fugitive? And does not live in the bounds of the country that he calls home.
And the legacy of his disclosures are a big part of the reason why I'm running. Insofar as, think of it this way, the authors of the Patriot Act were alarmed by what they learned from Edward Snowden.
Yeah.
After 10 years of oversight, they learned so little from executive officials through the formal channels that when the whistleblower came forward and said, here's what's happening, the authors of the Patriot Act were alarmed enough to adopt legislation restraining some of its worst abuses while leaving many other problems to be fixed, and Congress has never returned to them. And, Snowden performed an incredibly vital public service. If you think of his act in the context of Eisenhower's warning, it was an act of incredibly brave patriotism. The incumbent in the seat I'm running for, representing America's most progressive city, has derided him as a criminal, which I think is in itself reflective of serving power instead of people. And that's exactly what I want to reverse. I want to hit two points really quick. A few minutes ago, we were talking about the corporate domination of policy. And I'll just cite, there was a Northwestern University and Princeton University study that rigorously assessed congressional policy over the last generation and empirically identified that mass movements and citizens groups have effectively little to no influence, and money drives Congress, which is to say we live in an oligarchy and not a democracy. And that was whatever else we might claim, at the end of the day, our policy is driven by corporate money, and that has to stop. And ultimately, that's entirely about who do we put in and who are they listening to. And where do they come from and what have they done? And all I've done over the course of my career is fight government and corporate abuses. The other thing I wanted to touch on was this idea of, this is going back maybe half an hour ago now, but we were talking about the alignment among Americans who might perceive themselves as inhabiting different sides of the spectrum.
Sure.
Who might, for instance, on issues like civil liberties, on issues like drug policy, on issues like money in politics, find a transpartisan consensus in the face of a bipartisan institutional rejection of that consensus, which is why, you know, I just wanted to again hit this note of the left-right spectrum realigning to the center versus the periphery. And I aim to represent the periphery and all of the parties and all of the Americans who are unrepresented in a challenge to an icon of the corporate, bipartisan corporate establishment. And I am running as a Democrat, but I'm running against the Democratic Party machine. And ultimately, I am aligned against all the party machines, and I am very committed to the people. And I, there's a point here when we were referencing this sort of idea about the, you know, the FCC's commitment to net neutrality principles, the congressional need to guard against militarization of police, the need to guard the integrity of the political system and the electoral system. There's sort of this common thread across our conversation, and I just wanted to bring it back and locate it specifically to this president. And the idea that we need to have very strong, emboldened checks and balances at a time of history like this.
Absolutely. And, it's something that we've brought up numerous times on this show is that, A, unless we're actively at a state of war, the president is literally nothing but a figurehead.
So he's supposed to be.
In theory. Any power he actually has is ultimately checked by Congress. He can, sure, make treaties on behalf of the United States, but he has to have Congress's permission.
Yeah.
He can basically throw some baller parties whenever he wants.
He can invite the prince over and stuff like that, you know?
Or he can pull out of the Iran deal today.
He can pull out of the Iran deal. Stuff like that.
By constitutional, the way it's set up, he's supposedly limited. Yeah.
He's supposed to be.
Supposed to be.
Yeah.
They're all supposed to be.
But people are not, for whatever reason, checking his crazy, so.
Well, yeah.
He's getting away with murder.
Well, the executive order to begin with is something that has been abused, like Shahid was saying earlier. Eisenhower warned us when he left of the fact that we as a country had to literally give some control over government to private business in order to get this war accomplished. In order to make this happen, we had to sacrifice some rights. And if you people don't keep these people in check, you will lose them.
His last going out of office speech was basically kind of like almost like, that's Nostradamus, because it's happening. It's happening, Everything he's saying is a scary, real.
It's been happening. It is what set the groundwork for things like Air America in Vietnam. Exactly. It's what sets the groundwork for all black ops. It's what sets the groundwork for things like Gitmo. It's what sets the groundwork. I mean, for crying out loud, Oliver North just became the freaking president of the NRA.
Dude, he has a show on cable television.
I know.
Yeah. I mean, I watched his trial.
One of my latest DJ sets included a song by Stevie Wonder about lying presidents and executive accountability written for the Reagan administration around the Iran-Contra scandal.
Mm-hmm.
It's galling. And these are the issues that to me need to be politicized because I see them. You were saying at one point when we were talking that unless you look at the news really carefully, it's really hard to see these patterns emerge. And I see people who look at the news very carefully and never see these patterns emerge.
Yeah.
Or people who look at the law very carefully and never see these patterns emerge. But these are the patterns that it seems like you also see in very stark relief. And one reason I'm running for Congress is that these need to be election issues. We need to put these issues in front of voters and say, do you want to live in a constitutionally co-opted republic or do you want to live in a constitutional republic?
Thank you.
And do you want to have your rights or not? Do you want to be ruled by corporations or do you want to be ruled by yourself?
Well, and that's,
these are the kinds of issues that I want to make very sharp.
The frightening reality is the fact that we are but few elections away from that alternative, Shahid. This last election, this last presidential election, was probably the first time really since the Civil War that our country has been divided the way it has been.
Right.
Where it was literally, you know, families.
Yeah.
Broken up.
Yeah.
Over presidential elections and stuff like it that were utterly ridiculous to begin with. I mean, you couldn't have had a more farcical election to begin right. with. It was straight up, and you wonder why you yeah. won. Like, he's the king of reality TV.
Fight
like
your
that
brother.
Was that was like a 9 month episode like of like it. You know, Jersey Shore is what yeah. is what our election was.
That's a good one there. Yeah. And I think it's still going on. I think they got an extra season going.
You know, and just to look at that and to Stormy. See that, just that little piece of political prestidigitation that went on with everything that is so entirely left-right paradigm and so entirely left-right driven when good God, had this election would have never even come close to happening 50 years ago.
No.
Much
no.
less if it did happen.
Yep. No.
You know, like it 50 years ago, that's our right. politicians would have literally been run out of town on a rail. Like,
this guy 50 years ago?
Out.
Yeah.
Like three quarters of our politicians that are in the pockets of companies and stuff like that. Like, in our grandparents' day, it would have been like, no, you need.
Well, Reagan
no,
snuck in there.
You need to get out of here. He did.
He snuck in.
He did sneak
and
in.
And he was an actor himself, also.
And he was terrible, too.
Yeah.
Like, real bad.
Well, you know, ultimately.
Well, one thing that was happening 50 years ago or was not happening was corporations putting big money behind presumptive yeah. nominees,
right?
Yeah. And that's an example of the corporate corruption of the process. Oh, when you yeah. look at the 2016 election, one of the things that strikes me, it's amazing, for instance, that Democrats have slid so far to the right that they yeah. were actually outflanked on the left on economic populism by Donald Trump. You know, he ran
yes,
against
yeah.
secret
yes.
corporate trade agreements. And even a stop clock is right twice a day, and I'm not going to, you know, give the man any credit for being right on the issue. But at the end of the day,
yeah.
that's a winning position in the United States. And I'll tie together two issues here. We were talking about stingrays, and we're talking about secret corporate trade agreements and
sure.
Trump and Clinton. The first known deployment of a stingray in the United States was in a demonstration that I was part of. In the fall of 2003, I was marching with steelworkers and environmentalists in Miami trying to stop the free trade area of the Americas. Yep. Which was the WTO expansion of the time, the precursor to the TPP, the yep. TPP's Asian theater, and you know across the Pacific trade, whereas the free trade area of the Americas was going south toward Latin America. But you know, we were using military surveillance devices to spy on steel workers who were yep. trying to stop secret corporate trade agreements from taking all of their jobs. And you know, you fast forward down, you see Trump running on that issue. How did Democrats so abandon labor and environmental and worker rights? And that they were willing to throw their hat behind, you know, someone basically representing corporate interests. And at the end of the day, I think the go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say that was one of my issues to begin with, unfortunately, Hillary. She didn't even hit like the Rust Belt. You know, she didn't even go talk to steel workers, things like that, you know.
And Americans will respond
yeah.
to people who champion our interests, you know, and I think, again, across our stripes, across our left-right stripes, and certainly yeah. here in San Francisco, I mean, this is the bluest, most progressive city in the country.
Right.
People recognize that, you know, we all have some of the same threats and we need representatives to challenge those threats, those institutional antagonists, be they police, be they intelligence agencies, be they corporations. You know, one of my first cases before I even became a lawyer, when I was still a law student, I was defending Native tribes in Northern California from corporate geothermal power extraction on sacred land. And sure. this idea of, and you know, it's interesting about that case is it was actually theoretically renewable energy. It was just renewable energy that was toxic and, you know, reflected environmental racism in the fighting. So, you know, even supposedly green principles can be problematic in practice. You know, and
that's
it's
right.
really important that we think of these issues through the lens of the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that I
well,
informs my through, policy thinking.
Through the most vulnerable and through the most easily exploited. You know, I mean, it's come out recently that like a good third of the lithium for all of the batteries that we use and everything else come straight out of strip mines in Africa where slave labor's used. You know?
Yeah.
And when you look at that, when you look at the labor involved in that, and when you look at
it's just complicit in slavery.
Yeah. Like we are still to this day, to take it full circle, back to where you were about 30, 40 minutes ago, Shahid, the fact of we're still complicit in slavery to this day.
Right.
Slavery has not stopped. You look at the fact of if you paid $7 more for your iPhone, it could be made in America without 8-year-olds making it in China.
Right. I would pay 10.
Sure.
There you go.
See?
You know, and what do we do? What steps can we start? What strides can we make as people to, A, start bringing this awareness to our fellow man, to our common man, across the base, across the color spectrum politically and racially? What can we do to start enlightening people to these issues, Shahid?
I appreciate you asking the question. Before I ran for Congress, I spent the last 3 years building a network for the digital rights movement and civil liberties for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And our recommendations went something like this. Find a handful of neighbors who share your concerns, get together, talk about the issues, particularly talk about what you're going to do about them, and start with something simple. It could be as easy as a documentary screening in one of your living rooms where you each invite your friends, and then at the end of it, instead of three people, you've got 10. And then now you can do something like, you know, if you're going to do the same thing, instead of doing it in your living room, you do it at the community center. And then maybe you escalate into writing a letter to some representatives, and maybe you escalate into doing a rally outside City Hall when they're discussing the proposal for the measure that you might have brought to them, right? Engaging in the process and particularly activating locally. You know, all politics ultimately is local, and the need to think globally and be informed by the all of the issues that we know are intersecting around the world, but to take action locally. The key to me is taking action. My first album was called Get Out of Your Chair. Because at the end of the day, there's only so much we can do within it. And I think as much as the internet exposes us to information and it can expand our networks, we have to take action offline to meaningfully engage. And I think that's something that a lot of Americans, if we do, and especially if we recognize common institutional antagonists, follow me here for a second. I've spent a lot of time fighting police departments and different kinds of civil rights abuses around the country. And at the end of the day, whether you're a peace and justice activist, or whether you're a Latino who could be mistaken, whether you are or not, for being an immigrant, whether you're a different shade of brown, if you're African American, there are lots of different Americans who have been subjected to police abuses historically. I was robbed by Chicago police 3 blocks from my house in 1997 with my housemates. And, you know, the idea that the police are so offensive to so many different communities, on the one hand, is a reflection of how bad it has grown, but it's also a reflection of profound opportunity, because I think it is in the response to our common oppressors, be they police or intelligence agency or corporations, I think it is in that struggle that we have an opportunity to rediscover what makes us American beyond our various stripes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I agree totally.
Brilliantly said. Brilliantly said. So, and as we kind of wrap this episode, Shahid, tell everybody where they can go to find out more about your mission, more about your run for the 12th Congressional District there in San Francisco and California, and where they can find out more information about protecting their rights, about this technocracy that we do live in that has corporations deciding on the rights of individuals.
Thank you, Chris. Folks can learn more about my campaign to replace Nancy Pelosi in the House at www.shahidforchange.us. That's shahid4change.us. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Shahid for Change. Some places that people can learn more about your rights and these issues, check out EFF.org. That's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, for which I used to work. If you're interested in taking action locally and joining a network of other people like you in other places, check out the Electronic Frontier Alliance. It's the project that I launched at EFF. On the subject of the Eisenhower's warning and all the different ways in which it's come true, I wrote a chapter in a book about that called Ike's Dystopian Dream. It's in Project Censored's 2017 edition. But visit us online at Shaw Interchange or follow us on Twitter or Facebook. And we are putting a lot of time into pushing out not only reflections on current events, but also a lot of the articles that I've written over the last 15 years about these various issues. So we're aiming through our campaign not only to provide the voters of San Francisco with an alternative to bipartisan corporate corruption and an alternative for people over profit and communities before corporations, but also aiming to educate people. Please visit us online and reach out if you have questions, ideas, or introductions to anybody in San Francisco for us. We're very excited to connect with communities here.
Absolutely. And the information that you've shared tonight, the platform that you are running on, is so entirely important to our country, so entirely vital to not only the fabric of our country, but for people to understand. Thank you so much for coming on this evening. Please hold the line with us here, Shahid, as we close out the show. And please make sure to go online and check out his website, check out everything about Shahid, check out everything about the Electronic Frontier Foundation and what you can do to actively change the world around you, not only politically, but in a paradigm as a whole, in the way that we think about privacy, in the way that we think about society. And on that note, thank you so much for tuning in this evening, everybody. It's so nice to be back home with my folks here in the studio. Make sure to check us out on the HC Universal Network, hcuniversalnetwork.com. You can also find us on dudesandbeer.com. Until next time, everybody, if you can't be good, be good at it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.